Access number 28673, Mr. Don Mitchum, Real 7. Now, we're talking about your training at Usworth. This is operational training. Now, what formations would you learn? Was there one set formation or was there a variety?
No, there was a variety of formations. The basic one was what we called Vic formation, with, you know, one leader and one on each wing. Now, we didn't, to be honest, use that very much in later on in combat flying. The other one that we had to learn was line astern, right dead behind. And as you know, you've got to be below the slipstream. Because later on in combat flying, you did a lot of line astern flying. And the other was line abreast, you know, level. So we did. We used to practice all types of formation flying, and of course we used to practice flying as a squadron. And normally, a squadron would be 12 airplanes in the air. I mean, there were, we had about 18 pilots and a few more airplanes, but there's to be 12. And we used to do a lot of formation flying. Practice with those 12, and usually the one that we practice most, and when we come later on when we start talking about combat flying, I'll explain why, but the one that was used most was line astern, three lots of line astern, four in the middle and four either side, and each in pairs. So in other words, you flew as a pair. And you actually formated on the chap in front of me who was your section leader. The idea of that was when you got broken up in combat, you tried to stay together if you could, because that was...
Now, we'll come up... were you a natural at formation flying, or did you find it... Some people find it very difficult, apparently.
I certainly didn't find it easy. Yeah, I found it fairly difficult, or I don't know about difficult, but you know, you had to get used to it. It's a question of practice, really. But once you've been doing a lot of it, it comes more natural, I think. So yeah, it not difficult, but tricky, and you had to get used to it. But then, of course, we used to practice what we called battle climbs.
Now, what's a battle climb?
Well, that is, if you can imagine operational flying, if you're sitting in readiness and some Germans or whatever opposition comes over and you get scrambled, you have to, they're usually at a height, you have to climb up as quickly as you can. So the battle climb was you take off and quickly get into formation and climb as fast as you could. And that would be up to the leader, who would know what his limits were with his throttle setting and everything else. So, and of course, the other thing was when battle climb, you had to be careful not to forget to use your oxygen, because you could be in trouble if you didn't. So we used to practice battle climbs quite a lot, because that was going to be useful to us in the future, because as you quite rightly said just now, this is an operational training unit. Then, of course, we did practice what we called dogfighting.
Now, tell me about that.
Right. I suppose it's probably a throwback from World War One, where they used to do all sorts of dogfighting and doing them and turns and all this business. But the... In my way, my war, dogfighting was not quite the same as that. It was a series of passes at each other. If you got what we call, if you got jumped, in other words, if you were attacked by, let's call the opposition the Germans, they would always attack you when they had the advantage. They wouldn't attack you otherwise. The Germans are more sensible than that. And that meant usually coming out of the sun and from a higher position. So you had to practice a lot at spotting formations of aircraft above you and in the sun. And we found, going on further on a squadron, there were certain chaps who were better at it than others. They're pretty good at spotting things. And if you saw, I'm going on now to say, talk about dogfighting, but the conditions under which it happened and why. So if you saw them sitting up there in the sun, because they would always try and get on your tail, because that's the only way they can shoot you down. Because if you can imagine, if it was an airplane flying along like that, the best way is right behind. But if you're sideways on, you've got to turn quite a lot inside to shoot ahead. So you had to turn inside, and the turning was the thing. But so what we used to practice was that business of somebody who would, they saw them coming, they'd say, enemy bandits, we usually saw that, 12 o'clock high or something like that. And then somebody in squadron would be detailed. When they got to a certain point, they would shout, break left or break right. And if so, coming in towards the left, you always broke left towards them. And everybody split like that, up and in quick and turns. So that's what we had to practice, turning quickly. And then after that, the dogfighting part was trying to get on somebody else's tail, because that's the only way. And also, you had to be very careful that you kept your eyes behind you to see what was behind you, because they're the ones that shot you down was always the one that you didn't see. Always, really. If you could see it, he probably couldn't hit you. So that's where we had to. And if you see any pictures of last war fighter pilots, they're always wearing a silk scarf. And that isn't to look glamorous or anything like that, because nobody would fly with a tie on the side. It could give you more movement on your neck, so that you look from behind you, because although we had a rear mirror, nobody trusted that. You had to look behind you if you could. What they used to do, was to sometimes send us up in pairs to practice that, not as a squadron, but one chap would be flying along straight in the level, another would be higher and coming down at you, so that you could practice the right time to turn and to try and get inside him. And that was one of the exercises. Was
now this business about from the tail, any other shot, the deflection shooting was just too difficult at those speeds, was it? If you come in from the side or from the front.
Yeah, it was what you said, difficult. Well, if you tack head on, of course, it's the same as coming from back, but that could be a bit difficult because, a bit of collision if you're not careful.
So that wasn't adopted except in the last resort?
No, that's right. I mean,
couldn't, as you could in the First World War, attack from the side.
If you could possibly get behind, that was the best one. But you could, if you attack from the side, what you had to be very careful is even if he's flying straight and level, you've got to turn and aim ahead, because by the time your bullets get there, so you had, that's what's known as deflection shooting. And of course, the more this chap that you're attacking turns, the further ahead you had to shoot, because you had to get inside him. So yes, you could attack from the side, you could attack from underneath, but if the best form of attack was from behind. But if he was a good pilot, he wouldn't let you do that, you see.
Now, this is all attacking single-seaters. Did they practice you against bombers at all? Who, of course, have rear gunners.
Yes. Yes, we did. But from thinking back, We didn't do that at operational training.
That's
but
fine.
We did when we got on the squadron.
No problem. Now, what other sort of training? You know, it's a whole program to get you ready. What else training did
we
you
had
do?
To do, as I said earlier on, low flying.
Now, tell me about the low flying practice.
Right. They had a special designated area. And when I was at Usworth, it was up in Northumberland, which was the low flying area. And they used to send you off to practice low flying, which was the thing that everybody loved, because pilots love low flying, because you get the sense of speed, which you don't when you're up in the air. And that's where the CO told us that, you know, people got overconfident, and that's where they came to grief. In fact, a friend of mine his family lived at Washington, which was not far from the airfield, and he went to show off to his parents and flew flying low over the house, and unfortunately hit the ground instead, so he killed himself. But anyway, that's an aside. Yes,
now, what was the purpose of low flying? Is it for ground strafing, or what? Just explain what it.
Yes, for operational low flying of any sort. I mean, for ground strafing, or sometimes a bit later on on squadron, when you had maybe a target to attack, and you didn't want the radar to pick you up, you had to fly very low if you could to be beneath the radar. So you just had to be able to fly, because you had to be a bit careful because of the speed, you know.
Now, how low would you go, and how did you find low flying?
Well, we were told that you shouldn't really practice below 300 feet, but I mean, everybody did, and you'd get right almost down on the ground level. In fact, we used to, because that's where you got the thrill of flying, to be honest. And quite often, you know, you'd be flying down and you'd have to sort of bank to the left to miss a tree and stuff like that.
And did you find it a thrill?
Training.
Did you enjoy it?
Oh, loved it, yeah. Yeah. But as I say, in the end, it is good training, although, you know, we were told that we might... Oh, they also told us that when we were flying at about 300 feet, we ought to use partial flaps.
What do you mean?
You know, the flaps that go up and down that give you more lift, that you put down when you're landing. But you couldn't do that in Spitfire, but you could in Hurricane. You could put the flaps down a little bit, which would give you a little bit more lift, but would slow you up a bit. But nobody ever did that anyway. So it was just really a question of practicing flying low at high, what was in our day high speed, which wouldn't be now, of course.
Now, what other training, operational training? I mean, any gunnery, any shooting?
Yes, we had gunnery training, and we had two types of training for that. One was air to ground. And the other was air to air.
Now, take me the air to ground first.
Yeah, that's right. Well, we had a up in when I was at OTU, we had a stretch of beach in Northumberland that they was fenced off, and they used that, and they had targets on it. So bearing in mind we only had machine guns, but we had machine guns with. The bullets had those little marks on them that you could pick up colours that who'd hit what, you know. So we used to practice air to ground against the target, which was on the ground. Unfortunately, while I was there, somebody mistook a searchlight for a target. Which unfortunately didn't do the soldiers in the searchlight unit any help. He killed a couple of them, so we were in trouble over that. But that was just, he just, you know, misinterpreted it. But it was not air to ground. Then we had air to air firing, and we did that by having what's called a drogue. It's like an air thing that you get that shows you the wind speed. And that was towed. We had a Lysander airplane that used to tow these drogues. He used to take off and fly up and down a certain flight path with this drogue tailed behind him, and we used to have to attack it from various angles and shoot at it, and they could tell if we'd hit it or not. So that was the air-to-air.
Now, how did you do? Because one of the things about marksmanship in the air is it's not very good generally, as a whole.
No.
A lot of bullets fired, not many hitting the targets.
That's right.
Sort of, certainly in the First World War, and the people who stood out were the people who hit the target.
Exactly. Yeah.
Now, how did you do, and how difficult was it?
I would say that I was probably average. I mean, what you said is quite right. The big aces of the war were always the good shots. And that was a knack, I think, more than anything. Like, as if you're, you know, if you're firing on a range, a lot of people were so much better at it than others. But, yeah, it's...
What were your problems then? I mean, I accept average is not bad, but I mean, it does mean there are problems. What sort of problem did you have, or was it just difficult?
It wasn't difficult, but, it didn't seem difficult, put it that way. But I suppose probably that maybe I wasn't using the right deflection or something like that. Or maybe firing the guns further away or nearer the target than I should have done. Those are the sort of mistakes that you would make. But then a lot of people do, you know, I wasn't any different than anybody else, I suppose, really. But the real good shots were, it's just a knack, I think.
Now, anything else? What else were you learning?
I'm just trying to think. We talked about battle climb, dog fighting, formation flying. We did long distance cross country flying. That was purely to test your ability for navigation, because you've got to bear in mind that in a single engine airplane, you're the navigator as well as the pilot. And in those days, we didn't have all the navigation aids that they've got now. So what we had to do, and for instance, when I was at Udsworth, I can remember one of the cross-country tests was to fly to a place called Church Fenton in Yorkshire, which is down in the south of Yorkshire and back. So you had to get yourself there and identify yourself so that they would know you'd got there, and then come back. And we used to have to work out the courses and tracks and all that sort of thing with the wind speed that we'd learnt on. Because what our navigation was all what's known as dead reckoning navigation, which you just had to work out from, as I say, because you had no navigation aids. You know, you had to work out your wind speed and direction and your drift and your track. Because the course, do you want me to go into detail?
No, yes, I do, yes.
Well, when you're flying on the navigation, the point between A and B that you want to get from A to B, that straight line is called the track, and that is the line you want to fly on. But bearing in mind that you have a wind speed always, and certainly the higher you get, the higher the wind speed is, you would set your wind speed and direction. You put your track down, put the wind speed and direction on a triangle that way. Are you with me? Your wind speed would be across your track, either one way or the other, at a certain angle and at a certain speed. So you would work out the scale of the speed that you want, your airspeed on the track, on your wind, say, and joining that point to that one is the course that you would take, because the wind would take you on that track like that. So that's something that we had to get used to.
So you didn't just look on the ground and follow a river or anything?
Well, I was just going to go on and say to you that that it was the easy way. And funnily enough, when we had this cross-country test to do, one of the instructors, or one of my instructors, who was an ex-Battle of Britain pilot, he said, "Oh, you've got to go down to Church Fen and then back." He said, "To be honest, the best way is to follow the railway line." He said, "As you know, there's a railway line that goes straight from Newcastle to York." And I said, "I didn't really hear that, did I?" And he said, "No." But we had to practice doing it the proper way. But in practice, yes, we did do a lot of following railway lines. Not easy in this country because there's lots of roads and railway lines and things. But this is something that the chaps who were trained in America didn't come to terms. Their navigation was hopeless because over there there's so few landmarks that they knew exactly where they were all the time. And if they flew over a town, the gas holder or something had the name of it written on it. So their navigation was up the spout a bit. Now, can I just go and spend a penny a minute?
Yep.
Sorry about that.
Now, what about night flying? How much training on that?
Well, we had to do a certain amount of night flying. Not a great deal, it has to be said, because this was, of course, as I say, the end of the Battle of Britain. When the night fighters were beginning to come in, and it was decided that Hurricanes and Spitfires weren't really any good at night fighting. But obviously one had to learn to be able to fly at night because you might get caught coming back from somewhere and the night comes in, or maybe you had to take off at night to go somewhere. So we did a certain amount of night flying. Not a great deal, but enough to make you feel that you were at home doing it.
Did you use a sort of hood or blind flying?
Yeah, that's right.
Or did you do it at night?
No, we did. The actual night flying was at night, but we did a thing. We had a thing called a link trainer, which you were able to. I don't know if you've ever seen one of those or heard of it.
Can you describe them for them?
Yeah, it's like a little... it's on the ground, like a little cockpit, which you got in and put the hood, and you were in there with completely... All you had was the instrument flying, night flying instruments. And they acted the same... They were all run by gyros because this was back in the early days. We didn't have simulators in those days. And you could sit in there, and the instructor was outside. He had one of these crab things that would show the line that you were flying on and all that. And he'd tell you what to do and various things to do. So you would do that as if you were flying blind. And the instructor sitting outside will be able to see how you were doing. And of course you weren't in the air at all, but it was, I suppose, one of the original simulators, really.
How realistic was it for you inside there?
Not very.
Was it any use at all?
Yes, it was some use, but it wasn't really the same. The gyroscope instruments, like the direction finder and all that, and I seem to remember that when you got in it, you immediately, as soon as it was switched on, got into a spin, so you had to get out of that to start with so that you would then be showing that you were flying straight and level. It was in fact, because we had nothing else, it was useful. So that's as much as I can say, really, is useful. But it wasn't really simulating night flying. Well, for a start, when you're flying at night, even though it's dark, you can see something out the cockpit, even though it's not much, you know.
What about night landings? I mean,
Yeah, well, we had, I think I mentioned, because I saw it on your notes, about the glide path indicator.
So it's the same thing. It's
exactly the same. And bearing in mind that this is in the early days when we just had the old gooseneck flares set out in a T, which is, of course, the same as the landing lights along a runway, really, except that there's not as many of them and they're not as effective. We had to practice landing on the flares.
Now, how were you being assessed during this? Because if anything else comes to mind, do sing. But I mean, you were being assessed presumably
all the way along.
Now, how was it done? I mean, because they weren't in the aircraft with you. I mean, what was the sort of way they?
we're talking about knife flying. your instructor would be on the ground watching you doing the circuits and landings. Once you were in the air, and if you were away from the airfield, they didn't know, obviously. You could be doing anything, really, except, the radar might pick you up, but that wasn't very accurate anyway. So I suppose a lot of it was based on trust, really. And I think your instructor would get to know you, just to know how sort of capable you were. I mean, I know that we had one chap who at OTU had got his wings and everything, but he made a complete sort of cock up, can I say that, of all sorts of things. And he didn't make it to the end of the course, but he just was awkward, I think, in some sort of way. But generally speaking, the instructors would have to assess you on what they knew. I mean, if it was formation flying, of course, they'd be flying with you, or they might be leading the formation or whatever. Things like that, battle climbs and all that, they would know because they were with you. But if it was a question of going on across country, then it's a question of whether you got there and whether you got back all right on time.
Were you graded at all, or was it just pass or fail?
No, it was pass or fail, but you could get an assessment of average, below average, or above average. I don't think anybody got below average, otherwise you wouldn't have got that far. But one or two people, I got above average in one of my assessments, I know, but other than that, it was sort of average.
Now, how long was the course? You got there, January?
6 weeks.
So January to February?
Yeah, end of February. Well, unfortunately, we had some bad weather when I was there. We had snow up on the east coast, and so we spent a lot of time with shovels clearing the runway and drinking the rum that they used to give us. I think probably it was a couple of months before I finished.
So possibly into March then.
Yeah.